This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. My guest today is Gar Alperovitz. He's professor of political economy at the University of Maryland College Park. He's the author of America Beyond Capitalism, Reclaiming Our Wealth, Our Liberty, and Our Democracy, which has been recently revised. And he's come out with something more recently, an e-book, I think, which is adapted in part from, I gather, America Beyond Capitalism. It's called, If You Don't Like Capitalism, You Don't Like Socialism, What Do You Want? The subtitle is The Possibility of a Pluralist Commonwealth and a Community-Sustaining Economy. Gar Alperovitz, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
It's been 3 decades since I've seen you. Yeah. When you were in Washington, D.C. doing work along similar lines. How have you managed to keep going?
Well, it's just, you hang in. And things are opening up in terms of people really interested in economic alternatives, worker co-ops, worker ownership, city ownership, neighborhood ownership. So there's a lot of concern given that nothing else is working. People have opened their mind into considering a whole series of what I call democratization efforts, particularly democratization of wealth, which I think is the central critical issue of any systemic issue, change issue.
And what do you mean by democratization of wealth?
Well, if you look, 400 people in the United States, 400 individuals have more wealth than the bottom 180 million people. It's probably more now because that's a little bit out of date and the concentration of wealth has gone up, not down. So if you think about that, that's medieval. I mean, I don't mean that rhetorically. That is literally the way medieval society was organized. If you want to build a system that's democratic, a lot of it revolves around property. And if you don't want it in the state and the concentration of power that means, then it's got to be decentralized. And then the question becomes how. So worker-owned companies are one piece. Cooperatives are another. Neighborhood ownership, there's a lot of that going on. City ownership, there are, 25% of American electricity is either municipally owned or co-op owned, socialized if you like, but in a decentralized way. So we've been kind of looking at all these different models and seeing that they can be built up, particularly given the emerging context of stagnation, pain, where nothing else is working. You can actually build from the bottom if you roll up your sleeves and start doing it.
Well, I understand that there are these successful things going on locally, but when you see the amount of power amassed in those 400 individuals and in their wallets, and when you see the power that is amassed in the hands of the hugest corporations in this country, it seems to me there's still kind of a chicken and egg question, which is how do you wrest power from them? When they have all the power and when they control so much of who is elected to our elected bodies. Do you have an answer to that?
It's a good question. But, I wear two hats. One, I'm a political economist. The other, I'm a historian. So, empires come and empires go. People fighting against very long odds and winning over time is not unusual. Revolutions are as common as grass in world history. But if you look at it this way, the way I think about it is you lay the next 2-3 decades on the table. They're going to control a lot of what's going on. And they are also generating pain, dislocation, anger, loss of belief in what they're doing, and people beginning for the first time in a long time, the last several years, beginning to say, either we're going to take it into our own hands or they're going to run the show forever.
Were you surprised by the Occupy movement?
I was not surprised by... I was surprised by the timing, but if you look at the first edition of this book, pretty much predicted that this had to happen at some point, and several people have noted that.
No, you did predict it. The book is America Beyond Capitalism, Reclaiming Our Wealth, Our Liberty, and Our Democracy. The author, my guest today on Progressive Radio, is Gar Alperovitz. Yeah, I did notice that, and it was quite prescient, actually. You said that the contradictions were going to be so much, the pain inflicted was going to be so severe that people at some point weren't going to take it anymore, and there'd be what you called a 21st century populism. And we saw that with the Occupy movement. That label, populism, has also been given to the Tea Party. Do you think that's accurate?
Well, two things. The other thing that seemed clear to me, which is also in the oddly predicted, I'm not in the prediction business, but I thought the 99.1% was the dividing line, and boy, they came to it right away. Populism has a strange history. It really gives you the flavor of the many against the few. Fine, that's good enough. But a 21st century populism, if you want to use that language, the kind of populism I would be interested in, or if you want to call it socialism or communitarian or cooperativism, it's got to change ownership of wealth. The Tea Party is not interested in that at all. They have a genuine concern, leaving aside all the ridiculous parts, with the question of liberty, and people are rightly concerned about liberty. Not so much in there's a cultural thing going on with the Tea Party that I don't quite understand, but it does touch on the liberty question, which is real. I mean, the left should have concerns about liberty as well.
You write about liberty in an interesting way in this book, America Beyond Capitalism. You talk about liberty being an economic issue, that liberty requires job security. Elaborate on that.
Yeah, the civil liberties aspect has been taken over rightly by lawyers. There's a whole series of questions protecting constitutional rights. But real freedom depends upon having a power base to operate from. For instance, if you're a tenured professor at a university, they can't fire you and you can say whatever you want. That's real liberty. Most people don't have that, and most professors are going to be losing it as they grind away at this. In the 19th century, small businessmen, mainly farmers, provided at least something to stand on that gave them liberty. A guaranteed job or a guaranteed income of some kind gives you the economic base of liberty. That's the context. Without that, you know, people are frightened, and rightly frightened. They lose their job, their family, their house, if they say the wrong thing. So true liberty depends upon an economic substructure. It takes a lot more than that, but that's one of the requirements.
So are you for, then, a guaranteed income or so-called social wage?
Sure. The good society would provide a guaranteed income or a guaranteed job, both. I mean, that and this you know, most people don't realize when I say this, people get startled. We do not have an economic problem in the United States. We have a political problem managing the wealthiest nation in the history of the world. The economy, even now, is producing something like $190,000 for every family of four. It's a question of distribution and managing the economy so that it's well used. So we could have a bountiful system if we wanted to, and part of it would be some sort of guaranteed job and a guaranteed social wage.
But we don't have it because the powerful are running the show and they're greedy.
Indeed, yeah, and the power structure is getting more concentrated rather than less. But again, if you stand back and look at what's happening at the grassroots level, the press can't cover most of this. It's not interested, doesn't have the money, and it doesn't have the support system.
I know you've been covering it. Jim Hightower has covered it. Ralph Nader's covered it a little bit, but it's few and far between.
Well, what I'm finding is I was just out in Seattle and in San Francisco. I'm finding that people are doing this stuff and let me give you a website, community-wealth.org. That's a website that we run, but it just maps all these co-ops and worker-owned companies and land trusts and municipalizations, state-owned efforts, et cetera. 27 states invest directly in own shares in companies now, socialism, if you like, partial socialism. That stuff is all over and can be replicated, or the Bank of North Dakota, some 17 or 20 states are interested in that right now. There's a lot going on that people can do and are doing, but not covered by the press, except, you know, places like the Progressive get into it. But we've got to get the word out because people are at the point where they want to do something, and I'm seeing it all over the country.
I love the Bank of North Dakota. This is obviously a state-owned bank, and it isn't in the business of maximizing profits for private shareholders, quite the contrary. Explain how it works.
Well, it's essentially a socialist bank, and it was put forward by the socialists about 95 years ago. And it then became part of the populist movement. And there it is, the state owns the bank. And it makes a lot of money, and it gives it back to the state. Instead of taxes, you've got money from the bank, or it supplements taxes. It also supports a lot of small community banks directly, the retail part of it. And many states are considering. I think last I saw 17 or 18 states had legislation submitted to set up a Bank of North Dakota. Several cities are beginning to try to use their deposits either to support credit unions that do community investing or small banks that will do the same thing. So using their financial leverage of the city or the state in a way without creating a new bank. But I think we're going to see a lot more of it. I was in Washington State, and they're considering setting one up. They're about the farthest along so far, and Oregon, I think, is next.
I'm speaking with Gar Alperovitz. He's the author of America Beyond Capitalism, Reclaiming Our Wealth, Our Liberty, Our Democracy. And there's a version, an ebook on the web you can get if you don't like. It's called "If You Don't Like Capitalism, You Don't Like Socialism. What Do You Want?" But in a way, this is, as you say, a socialist vision as far as banking goes and public ownership goes, and worker ownership goes. So, what about the S word?
Well, you know, it's a very down-home socialist, very American. I'm from Racine, Wisconsin. Every one of the things we're talking about, you can explain to my conservative high school buddies if you know what you're talking about, if it's practical, and if you show concrete how it helps the community. So then when you get to that level, we've been involved in a big project in Cleveland, Ohio, a whole series of integrated worker-owned co-ops. And they look very much, you know, this is co-op, socialism, whatever, but the small businessmen benefit. We don't have problems at that level with right wing, left wing. It's very positive. And these are large scale co-ops.
What do they manufacture?
Well, the biggest one is now just about to open up. It will be the largest fresh food kind of place where you can grow vegetables, lettuce, et cetera, in the entire United States in an urban setting. That is to say, it's under glass, it's solar, et cetera. 3 million heads of lettuce a year. That's its capacity. Very large, modern greenhouse structure owned by the workers. And then there's a big industrial-scale laundry because they serve the hospitals in that area. Again, industrial scale, the greenest laundry in that part of the country, uses about a third of the water and the heat. Again, owned by the workers in that area. And then there's a big, big solar co-op, worker-owned solar co-op. It's about to put in more capacity than exists in the whole state of Ohio. What's unique about it is it's not just freestanding worker-owned co-ops. They're linked together with a Mondragon-style kind of revolving fund. So they're trying to build the community, and they contribute to a community nonprofit, not just, you know, I'm for worker ownership, but some of the worker-owned companies just tend to make a couple guys rich. These structures are trying to build the community.
You mentioned Mondragon-style. Explain that.
Well, Mondragon is this big, big Basque kind of set of co-ops, 85,000 people in a highly sophisticated co-ops, integrated co-ops, or about 85 co-ops.
In Spain.
In Spain, yeah, in the Basque country of Spain. High-tech, very advanced. Ratio of top-to-bottom salaries in most of them, in about 80% of them, are 6-to-1. And in the biggest one, it's 8-to-1. Now, most American corporations, it's 250-to-1, the big corporations. And this is high-tech, as well as agricultural, as construction, research, R&D, competing successfully. It was a very interesting model that people are beginning to try to adapt.
Have you been over there?
I haven't been over, but several of our people have gone over regularly. Mm-hmm. And what's happening in Cleveland is partly an adaptation of the Mondragon model. But it's advanced, I think, beyond Mondragon in the sense that it's community building. Mondragon has not taken on a specific design to build community. And also in the Cleveland model, we're using the power of big, big hospitals and universities, a lot of public money, education money, Medicare, Medicaid. They buy $3 billion of goods and services there and in many other cities, some part of which we're now directing to these worker co-ops to give them a kind of a planned market, a public market as a stabilizer.
And how do they make the sale to the universities or to the hospitals?
It's very interesting. It's complicated. In many cities, first, they benefit from it because it's a very poor area and they want to improve the area surrounding it for the people who come there. This is an area where people, average income is 18,000, black area. Secondly, some of these people, many of them have good hearts. Midwest, they care. And if you show them a practical way to use their power, that makes sense. And, I don't think the left has often done this. Often a lot of rhetoric, not very, very concrete. Here's what we could do. And when you get to that level, then you get a different discussion going on. So that was part of it. And then the third part was really just good organizing. Some of the people involved, some of our guys, did 140 interviews with procurement officers in hospitals and universities saying, what do you guys buy? Where do you buy it? Could you buy it if we had a worker co-op? What do you? And just one by one, really just hard shoe leather work. That's the way you do it. You roll up your sleeves and do it. And it's there are now many cities, Atlanta, Pittsburgh. There's even some discussions in Milwaukee and Chicago trying to replicate the model. And I think you're going to see a lot of it happening around the country. And it's a very, very sophisticated model that we're just builds on the co-op or social tradition in a very new way.
I'm speaking with Gara Alperovitz. I'm Matt Rothschild. You're listening to Progressive Radio. Gara Alperovitz is a professor of political economy at the University of Maryland, College Park. He's the author of America Beyond Capitalism. It's a book I highly recommend. Subtitle, Reclaiming Our Wealth, Our Liberty, and Our Democracy. There's a new edition out. And it's quite profound, and I think you'd get a lot out of it by reading it. Now, you mentioned Milwaukee, and you said you grew up in Racine. There's this tradition of socialism in Milwaukee, sewer socialism, as it were. Did that have an influence on you or your family?
You know, when I grew up in a fairly conservative culture in Racine, and I probably learned a lot about this at the University of Wisconsin. I was one of William Appleman Williams' student. I was going to be a chemist or a physicist or a doctor. So this was all when I came to the University of Wisconsin. I learned a lot, and thereafter kind of did a lot more work on it. So Racine was a pretty strong labor town, and I had some friends in the labor movement there. But my awakening came a little later. I was slow going.
Well, talk to me a little bit about your awakening. I'm always interested in people's biographies. At some point, you had an awakening. How'd that happen?
Well, I began to learn about politics at the University of Wisconsin and history. You know, Williams was a really powerful figure. And then also I was Bob Kastenmeyer, the congressman from this area. I was his legislative assistant. Then I ran Gaylord Nelson's legislative staff for a while, and I was policy planning at the State Department for UN matters.
What was Gaylord Nelson like?
Oh, Gaylord was a kick. He was a very relaxed guy. He would, he'd take on the war in Vietnam, which I was involved with, wrote some of the stuff, the Gulf of Tonkin resolution we challenged. Gaylord was willing, and he'd hire guys like me, firebrands at that time, to kind of poke him, keep him going. And he knew what we were doing, and the draft, that sort of thing. But he wanted some energy. Gaylord was just a terrific human being, wonderful guy.
I went to his memorial service at the Capitol in Madison, and someone told a hilarious story about he and his wife having their 60th wedding anniversary, and someone came up to his wife and asked what the secret of their long marriage was, and she responded, "We're both in love with the same man."
That's true. Carrie Lee, his wife, Carrie Lee, was famous for those kind of remarks, and also she's a really interesting woman.
Yeah, I think women will appreciate that joke of hers.
Right.
Now, you were there during Earth Day?
No, I was just before Earth Day. I was his legislative director during the Vietnam War.
So, but you saw these uprisings. You saw the Vietnam War activism here, and then you saw Earth Day take off from almost out of nowhere.
Yeah.
Similarly, Occupy took off
right
out of nowhere. What lessons do you draw from that?
Well, I was involved in the early anti-war movement, and I was at Harvard at the Institute of Politics, and I always remember the kids used to be playing on the banks of the Charles River. Frisbees and flirting one day, and then one day they were gone. And what happened was almost as if you turned a switch, the anti-war movement exploded, and they stopped playing Frisbee and start getting out to try to end the war. So I'd read about this phenomenon, and I'd seen it, but I then saw it and began participating in something we called Vietnam Summer that we organized with Martin Luther King and Ben Spock to start spark the anti-war movement in the late 60s. But I saw the explosion that's possible, just as you've seen Occupy. So I'm, both as a historian and also just in my own life, I've experienced that, and I think we're going to see a lot more of it. We have not seen the end of the explosions and the kind of organizing that could come from it.
And we had a real explosion here in Wisconsin over the last 2 years when Scott Walker came to power. I mean, a lot of us have waited our lifetimes for a real mass movement, and we had a really organic, gigantic mass movement here in Wisconsin that fortunately didn't topple the governor, but I think inspired thousands, tens of thousands of people, and had a lasting influence on a bunch of those people. So that was interesting. But that brings to mind a point you make in your book, R. Alperovitz, the book, again, America Beyond Capitalism, and that is that one of the fundamental changes in the United States over the last 60 years now has been the decline of organized labor.
Right.
Organized labor, John Kenneth Galbraith wrote about it as one of the great restraining forces, intermediary forces between corporate power and consumers, workers, that it's so decimated right now. What effect does that have on our system, and how do we get around that problem, or how do we resuscitate organized labor?
Well, I think that, the trend has gone from the peak of 35.3% in 1954. That was the peak. I mean, Sweden was 80% of the labor force organized. It's now 11% in general, roughly, and 7% in the private sector and going down. That's an institution that gave muscle to the progressive part, the Democratic Party, or worldwide. And one of the reasons I'm interested, and this, I think this is critical, in building up these alternative institutions, worker-owned companies, co-ops, land trusts, unless we build institutions as part of the next politics, we will be fighting against other people who are working from institutions plus politics, and we'll have only politics. So I don't think many people have really quite grasped that you, with the decline of labor and the institutional base of a progressive movement, either we build a new direction that has power institutionally as well as political mobilization and movement building, or I think we're going to lose. So thinking about worker-owned companies and co-ops and land trusts and municipal ownership, it's not simply these are good things to do. They begin to build a base that can have some lasting power and some muscle to go along with the politics that we're developing. And I think that's critical. And I think it's beginning to happen quietly because of the pain levels are so bad. It hasn't quite got the theoretical aspect, has not yet clicked in. But I think when that happens, I think we're going to see strategy, not just experiments. And when strategy hits, I think we get a politics.
It's interesting you mentioned institutional base. And there, as far as the Occupy movement, it seems to have faded a little bit, and maybe that's because there wasn't an institutional base, or they didn't create an institutional base out of the spontaneous uprising, which reflected mass awareness, middle-class awareness, right, working-class awareness that the rich are running the show, that the top 1% runs the show, and that democracy is a rigged game here. Right. So the awareness was there, the street protests were there, and yet there hasn't been enough to date, and maybe that will change to solidify that into an enduring force or an institutional base.
Well, one of the things I've seen come out of Occupy is that a lot of people who didn't know each other and didn't know that there were other people concerned about politics learned that from the Occupy movement. So in many different cities, what you see is small groups, five, six people trying to do something, six people here, seven people there, some of it institution building. I was in Vermont recently. And, you know, these big credit unions have got a lot of money. They could be using that money to finance co-ops, worker-owned companies, et cetera. Most of them are pretty stable, kind of staid organizations. They're also one-person, one-vote institutions. And the guys in Vermont have mounted a campaign, and they're starting to take over the credit unions. It's like a citizen bank, and using its power to fund up some of these other things. So I'm seeing little kind of small groups precipitated out of that explosive stuff, doing work at the grassroots level, and I think that's very important.
And some of the work they're doing is fighting foreclosures.
Yep.
And again, we get to the problem of the banking system in this country, but that's been a very promising thing that has grown out of the Occupy movement and really gets to people where they hurt and where they live.
Yep. I often say that, and again, I think about it both as an activist who, you know, with the Vietnam War experience and going way back there and the civil rights, and also as a historian. You're talking about the most powerful political economic system in the history of the world. And you want to play the game of changing that system? It's decades of hard work building over time. So I often say, you want to play? The chips are decades of your life. And if you think it's going to happen in instant pop, pop, bam, it's all over, don't play. But if you're serious about it, there's a lot of things that can be done. And, you know, go to that website, community-wealth, or kind of read my book. Lots of books out there. There's a lot going on. I've been speaking, as I said earlier, Matt, all over the country, and I'm amazed at what's going on in different parts of the country that just isn't covered by the press.
But it's a hard sell, Gar Alperovitz, isn't it, when you tell someone, you know, you can't solve this thing overnight, it's going to be decades, you got to put in decades of your life. I think someone who's listening in her car right now or in his office or in their kitchen, they're going to say, wow, man, I can't afford that, I can't put that, I can't invest that much.
Well, you know, I'm sure there are a lot of people like that, right? But I see people, I sometimes say it's an old Chinese expression, you walk on two legs. You do what you can do in the immediate right now, one leg, and you build for the future. I think there are a lot of people who are beginning to realize that that's what this is all about. And there are a lot of people who don't want to do that. So I honor them, and I think they should enjoy whatever they're doing. But I suspect you might find more people who are beginning to gear up and saying, hey, this is really important. Look, back off in the sense that if you think about societies around the world, what we're talking about is very common. People under very great duress. Look at those Latin American dictators who just disappeared. How did that happen? People dug in, began to build for the long haul. So I don't think this is high at all unusual in world history. And I suspect there's a lot of Americans willing to, you know, gear up and grasp and begin to think strategically about all this, as well as, I mean, you know, you've got to do what you can do tactically in the elections and so forth. But laying down a longer-term strategy is the name of the game.
And I would also just urge people to do it with friends, you know, and have fun doing
yeah.
it. You know, do it with people who are lively, have good senses of humor, who are good cooks, tell good stories, you have good senses of humor. Otherwise, it becomes an almost unbearable task. But if you do it with like-minded people who stimulate you, why, and that's what we have here in Madison, Wisconsin, a great community of like-minded people like this. It makes doing activism rewarding in and of itself in the process, even before you get to the 30-year change that has to happen. Your book, Gar Alperovitz, America Beyond Capitalism, raises a question that I thought about a lot. I haven't seen addressed in that many places. Others, I guess, Kirkpatrick Sale and other people have talked about it. But the fundamental question is the United States too big for democracy?
Yeah, it's a very important question. And again, it's got to be posed because we're at about 318 million people. This is a continental system. You can drop Germany into Montana. Mm-hmm. I sometimes say to students, you know, all those dinky little European countries, because they're very small polities. And we're going into 500 million, maybe 700. The Census Bureau high projection by the end of the century is 1.1 billion. Now, you tell me how you're going to have participatory democracy at that scale. And, you know, the design was, Madison's design was to keep scattering people so that you could concentrate the power. That's Federalist 10, keep dividing people with the property, just like Karl Marx. People with the property are the ones that need to divide the others, was Madison's idea. So spreading them out was a good idea if you wanted to control the center. Ultimately, the continent and a billion people is too big. Most states are too small. So ultimately, the logical result is that some democratic design has got to be regionalist in some form. And there was a whole conservative and liberal debate about that in the 30s, both left and right. And I think we're going to come around to that as we go down this path. Because, you know, Washington is, as they say, broken. But part of it is part of its power games. And part of it's just simply scale that you can't organize democracy in that scale.
And I think for a citizen, you know, it's hard to influence what goes on in Washington. And it just seems so remote, so far out of reach, so much in the hands of the corporatists. But at the local level, you can see your work sometimes come to fruition. And so I also encourage people to get involved locally. I have this idea of forming progressive councils in towns and cities across Wisconsin and then having them gather at an annual conference of progressives and formulate demands and proposals and then push forward that way. And but, you know, starting locally is, I think, a wise bit of advice that you bring.
That's the only way.
Yeah, you've got we only have a minute left. You've got a vision of what you call the pluralist commonwealth. If you could just describe that briefly, I'd be interested, and I imagine our listeners would too.
Well, ultimately, if a lot of power goes with who owns the wealth, and if you don't want to put it in the state because that makes it too concentrated in the old socialist model, and you don't want to put it in the corporations, then either it's decentralized in plural ways, co-ops, worker-owned companies, city municipalities, 2,000 municipalities, neighborhood ownership, plural forms of ownership in a radically decentralized way, and the power goes with it in a decentralized way. I call it a pluralist commonwealth, but it's a way to just democratize wealth in many, many diverse ways, building from community where you can actually do something and building up over time to a larger vision. And the principles, I think, can be applied and will be applied at the national level as we learn them at the local and state level.
So my guest today has been Gar Alperovitz. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks, Jim.
The book again, America Beyond Capitalism, Reclaiming Our Wealth, Our Liberty, and Our Democracy. Go get it. Read it. Go to the website community-wealth.org. It'll really open your mind. We'll be back next week with another show.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.